week of October 25th, 2020, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 516, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in Disney World, I'm Michael Giltz.
Wait, you're actually in Disney? I thought it was closed.
No, Disney World is not closed. Disneyland is closed in California. I'm outside Disney World waiting for my friend Shonda Rhimes, the highest paid showrunner in television, powerful woman, Grey's Anatomy, et cetera, et cetera. And she and I are heading into Disney World, just going to have a fun day out.
Okay. Yeah. Because, you know, Disneyland here in California, they actually said, okay, well, here is how you can reopen. You know, Disney, you faulted us for not telling you how you could reopen. So basically what they did was they restated everything they had said previously backwards. I was like, wait, that's exactly what you said before.
That's not where I was going.
Okay.
There's a great feature in The Hollywood Reporter about Shonda Rhimes, about her claiming her success and all this stuff. And of course, she jumped from ABC Disney to Netflix.
Yes.
And having read this story, I want to tell Netflix, for the love of God, as if you shouldn't have done this already, I assume you would, make sure you have given Shonda Rhimes Netflix for free, and all her family for free, and her friends and anybody else she wants to include should be getting Netflix for free, because she's a very valuable person and you'll want to keep her happy. In fact, what happened with Disney, and let her have the subscription where she can also get DVDs, you know, the big one, you know, don't skip, don't put her at the freemium level where she gets some commercials. That's not what Netflix does, but you know what I mean? Make sure she gets everything you can possibly offer her and her spouse and her children and her auntie and whoever else. Because in the Hollywood Reporter story, it turns out Disney, unbelievably, was skimpy on giving her passes to Disneyland. They were like, oh, well, how many you need? Three? Really? You're sure you need three? They're giving her a hard time.
When I worked for Disney, there was something called the Silver Pass, which, by the way, they still have.
Right.
And I would get it as an executive. I would get the Silver Pass. But over time, they started cutting back on who, like what level of executive you had to be to get the Silver Pass.
That's okay. But whatever level you set, Shonda Rhimes is above it. You want to make sure the woman, you know, programming your Thursday night television, massively successful, popular, and profitable, gets whatever she, give her mouse ears, you know, give her whatever she wants. And she was saying, oh, she had a pass. Her child had a pass, but she wasn't going with them. It was going to be the nanny or babysitter going to
the
child, and she was going to meet them later. She called them up and asked if she could ask, like, may I please have an extra pat? And they're like, don't you have enough? And she said, oh, okay. Well, thank you very much for your time. Hung up, called her agent and said, get me to Netflix. She's like, enough. You're giving me a hard time about a pass. I want out. I'm going to Netflix. I am not valued here, and I'm going to go somewhere where I'm valued. So please, Netflix, make sure you give her the pass. And you've had a pass this week too, haven't you, to the AFI Fest?
Yes, I've been using my pass quite wisely, in fact. Now, I want you to think about some of these movies that I'm about to mention here. Not all of them are necessarily worth seeing, and I would say there's one that's not worth seeing necessarily. Right. Not because it's bad, but because, you know what, if you missed it, you're not missing much. What do they all have in common? And I saw more than this, but I'll just say these. First, I'm going to start with The Intruder. Okay, this is an Argentinian film by Natalia Mehta. Then there's, Under the Open Sky. This is a Japanese film. It is very lovely. I could see how some people might say, oh, it's a little melodramatic at the end and a little too formulaic, but
that's by director Miya Nishikawa, right?
Right. Now, mind you, I go into these films, I don't know anything about these directors, or I don't even look them up. Farewell Amour was a Sundance movie, okay? And it was directed, and Farewell Amour is about Angolans who come to the U.S. The husband's been in the U.S. for 17 years. The wife and now teenage daughter are joining after 17 years of being separated. Uh-huh. So that was directed by Ekwa Mzangi.
I think.
Yeah. A very touching film.
I'm seeing a pattern. Keep going.
I Carry You With Me, also a huge Sundance hit, an epic love story that across two countries. Heidi Ewing.
This describes our friendship. I carry you with me, Sperling. Yes.
Yeah. And then this is a very funny film, My Donkey, My Lover, and I, which at first I took a flyer on it. I thought, you know what? This is going to be horrible. But it was actually quite funny. Carolyn Vignal directed this film.
Is the donkey the lover, or are they three separate people? No, I'm just wondering, is it My Donkey, My Lover, and I? Or is it My Donkey, and over there, My Lover, and then I?
It's like four separate people then.
Because
it's basically...
So they're all directed by women, obviously.
Yes. And so you have all of these festivals saying, we're going to do 50% women. And it just so happened. I didn't pick these. I said, oh, that looks interesting. This looks interesting. I'll watch this one. I'll see this one. And I'm watching these things, and I'm like, oh, when I get to the Q&A portion, it's a woman director. Okay, great. I didn't know that when I realized one after another was directed by women.
Well, that's what happens when you have diversity and you have the opportunity to see things. It's not that you're going to just say, well, we don't care if it's good or bad. We're just going to put it up. No, you have good product. There's good novels being written, good music being made, good TV shows, good poetry, good film being created by women. They just need the access and the ability to get it out to the world.
Well, and if you were asking me which ones you should see in order, I would say I Carry You With Me, Under the Open Sky, Farewell Amour, My Donkey, My Lover and I, and then The Intruder.
Which one will be on your best of the year list?
Probably I Carry You With Me.
All right. Well,
it definitely has a shot of making that. That's for sure.
All right. Well, yes, in this year, I'm assuming it will make it. So that's what you would tell me if I asked you which ones to see. But now I want to ask you, what are we going to talk about this week on the show?
Well, that was it. We're done.
Oh,
no,
great.
I'm just kidding. This week on Showbiz Sandbox, we are just really days away from the U.S. presidential election.
Vote.
That's right. If you go to any website now, they're telling you to vote. If you watch television, they're telling you to vote. So we pretty much have to tell you to vote. It's law now.
Yeah.
But really, the election won't stop us from talking about worldwide box office. Okay. That will never stop us from talking about. There's very little that will stop us. James Bond, by the way, is being shopped around. We're going to talk about that. We're not going to stop talking about the TV reboot of Smokey and the Bandit. Okay. Free course for everybody. I have no idea what that joke references, by the way.
You've not seen Smokey and the Bandit?
I have not, actually. No, that is, there's a hole in my...
He is smuggling Coors beer. It used to only be available in certain states. So if you wanted to drink Coors at that time, you had to smuggle it into the state. And that was the plot of the movie.
Okay. Well, now you've given it away. Spoiler alert. Okay. No, really, you can't stop us since box office actually, we've talked about how there's no box office here in the US, but China and Japan, watch out. It's back. Okay. And hopefully we'll get back on track soon, wherever you are. Okay. On Inside Baseball, we'll perform an autopsy on Quibi, Jeffrey Katzenberg's face flop of a platform, though I guess Meg Whitman was also a part of it. Of course, they'll complain. Everyone was writing its obituary even before it launched, kind of like us, by the way. So, maybe we had a point since we said, what? In any case, speaking of obituaries, we've got a lot of them, but I'll make certain, unlike myself, Michael will keep it moving. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll discuss some of the week's top headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on last week's box office. We told you couldn't keep us from talking about it.
And here it is. That's right. We're looking at box office around the world for the week ending October 25th. And the number one movie around the world is that Japanese film Demon Slayer, the movie Infinity Train or Mugen Train. It grossed $58 million this week. It's at $102 million worldwide. It made a lot of money during the week. It's still going very, very strong. So that's that is a big hit. And people saw it and they liked it. And number two around the world is Sacrifice. This is a new film. It's a Chinese drama set during the Korean War. It grossed $53 million on its opening week. Right below that is another Chinese film. It's that patriotic documentary omnibus called My People, My Homeland. That made another $23 million. That's at $390 million worldwide. Right below that, another Chinese film. This is the animated movie Jiangxia. It grossed another $16 million. It's at $233 million. Below that, Tenet, not doing as well, given its budget size. It grossed $8 million this week. It's at $342 million worldwide, slowly coming to an end. I don't think there are any big territories left for it to open in. But China, China's doing okay. Coffee or Tea, that little Chinese comedy, that's chugging along. Another $8 million this week. It's at $41 million now. Doing less good business, The Story of Shibao, that made another $7 million. So it's at $14 million total. And finally, a movie that is playing in North America. It's Honest Thief, the action film starring Liam Neeson. That made another $6 million this week. It's at $11 million worldwide. Back to China, where Leap is playing. That's the volleyball film starring Gong Li. It also plays in some other territories. It's at $5 million this week. It made $120 million worldwide. And then a movie we were just talking about before the show, The War with Grandpa. That made another $3 million. That's at $14 million worldwide. And when I was looking at Honest Thief and The War with Grandpa, obviously they're opening up in North America. They're not probably making the money they would have made in normal times. And I asked you, I said, you know, do you think they're hurting these movies? Should they have just gone VOD? Would they do better? Unless, you know, is somehow putting them out at the box office and letting them, you know, not make a lot of money, is that hurting their reputation or how audiences will see them?
I don't think so. I think, you know, could it have been better? Sure. I mean, they could have released under normal circumstances where people aren't afraid of going to the movies.
And they would have made more money, for sure.
They would have made more money. But in terms of, I think people, they give these films a mulligan. You know, it's like,
and it gives them visibility, however little advertising studios are doing. And that's one of the big problems here.
Wait, studios are advertising?
Exactly. Yeah. So beyond that, the fact that they're being reviewed, that they're on these lists, you know, everywhere you look, box office and stuff, not being covered as much, but they talk about it. Then these new films, they get, you know, covered in multiple different ways. That free publicity helps and it raises their profile. So when they come to DVD or, you know, VOD and all that sort of stuff, people are like, oh yeah, I saw that movie. You know, I heard about that. I'll watch it. So it helps, I think. I think it's only positive. Plus, they can be released in other parts of the world and they can make a lot more money. You know, Honest Thief isn't even close to done yet. It's got a lot of other territories to go. Same with The War with Grandpa. The 800 is not going to play all over the world, I don't think. That's the Chinese film about one of their great struggles.
Their battles, yeah.
In World War II. That made $3 million. It's at $464 million worldwide. Greenland, the Gerard Butler flick, made $3 million. Vanguard, starring Jackie Chan, that just made about $2 million. And then we get down to The Nightmare Before Christmas. That made another $2 million. It's at $91 million total. A great job for a movie whose original budget was $18 million. Now you're looking at, you know, five-time multiple. You know, made five times what you spent to on it. And finally, The Empty Man. This is a horror thriller opening up in North America. It starred James Badge Dale. It made about $1 million for one good reason. Nobody knew it was coming out. It did not get very good reviews, that's for sure. So I think there's a combination of the movies they're choosing to dump sometimes or the movies that are really, really bad. And you think, well, that doesn't help anybody.
Well, you know, that you mentioned that The Nightmare Before Christmas tripled its budget, you know, more
five
than
five times. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I would say if you've ever been to a Disney store or to Disneyland or Disney World anywhere near Disney during the Halloween time period, it's all The Nightmare Before Christmas toys and tchotchkes and things
like that.
Oh,
I'd love to know what that franchise is worth overall. Let Henry Selick do whatever he wants. He has made them a lot of money with this movie. And just driving up and down the streets in Birmingham, Alabama, you can see yards decorated with stuff that they've purchased, not made by themselves, but Nightmare Before Christmas, like the ghost dog, Jack, the skeleton, you know, the Pumpkin King and other things. I see them all over the place. They're great visuals. They're cool. Even if you don't know the movie, you'll think they're pretty neat. So no, that's a big franchise, way beyond the fact that it grossed $91 million worldwide. But two films opened up, and they sort of struggled. One here in North America, finally, another one in China. In North America, that toxic teen drama, After We Collided, finally opened up. It opened up, however, only on 460 screens. I get the impression that AMC, you know, boycotted the movie because it's available day and date or whatever. Because I'm looking at the screens, it has the second highest per screen average in North America. So
yeah, but you know what? Look at North America. Do you know how much money was made at the box office in North America this past weekend?
Well, I know, but it wasn't on enough screens. My point is, if they had
$10 million, that's it.
Right. AMC had embraced this movie and released it and said, these are not normal times. Let's get over it and see what happens here. I bet there was a lot of money left on the table for After We Collided because the first movie was very popular. There are two more coming. And where it was playing, there was a lot of demand. So,
you know, I
think they made a big mistake, not in terms of the overall bottom line. But come on, experiment, see what's happening. Try and embrace any movie you can that you think can bring people back to the movie theaters. Young people are more likely to go. This movie is targeted directly at them, and where it was playing, it did well. If it was on 2,000 screens, you might be looking, instead of $600,000, you might be looking at $2 million. So I think that was a big mistake.
What is being discussed now amongst, well, not among exhibitors, but between exhibitors and distributors, is what's called a pandemic release window, meaning, well, this will be the release window during the pandemic. But as many exhibitors
I've spoken with,
what they have said is, look, this is not a pandemic release window. It's a precedent release window. Like, it's never going back. Like, once it gets to that point, they're never going to go back.
Right. This is AMC talking, who has just announced, we're going bankrupt and please buy our stock. They're selling 15 million shares of their company the day after they say, by the way, we think we're going to go bankrupt in 10 weeks. Please buy our stock. So maybe they should try something new. I am wholly in support of windows. I think it's very smart. I think it would be dumb of the studios to try to collapse it to 17 days. But extraordinary times call for extraordinary measures.
Well, okay, you mentioned the 17 days. That was an AMC deal with Universal Pictures. Yep. We have The Croods 2, a movie that some people say nobody has ever asked for. But
The first one made a lot of money.
I got to tell you, my kids love the first movie. They've seen it 1,000 times.
It made a ton of money. No. That's a valuable, valuable film.
But that said, the exhibitors I've spoken to have said, we can't tell you what the terms are. And I don't want to know them. But we're not necessarily all that enthusiastic about the terms. And they all kind of slowly tilt their heads towards AMC, which means this movie will be released in theaters around the Thanksgiving time period here in North America. And then probably maybe not 17 days, maybe 23, 24, 25 days later, just in time for Christmas, be available premium video on demand, which, by the way, might actually be appropriate. It might already be done. Maybe, maybe not. I don't know. But, you know, the whole thing with AMC, they're saying they're going to go bankrupt. That's an SEC filing, okay? Well, that SEC filing, they have to give all warnings. And they're saying, look, at current rate, it looks as if. Now, that said,
they don't have any more cash.
Now, Studio Movie Grill here in the U.S. did file for bankruptcy.
Yeah, no, that's not a, this is not just a, oh, well, we got to say this. This is a big problem for AMC. And The Croods grossed about $600 million worldwide. That was a success story. And they could build on it if they deliver with the sequel. So there's another movie, however, that opened up and didn't do well. It's the Chinese animated film Over the Moon. It's a film that is centered around the Mid-Autumn Festival. Problem? It was released 3 weeks after the Mid-Autumn Festival. Because of the Golden Week and National Day, this movie got pushed to the back of the line and they released the patriotic films. So it's kind of like releasing The Nightmare Before Christmas, which celebrates Halloween and Christmas, and putting it out in January, where people go, yeah, I'm really not in the mood for that. So it just got screwed over by the authorities and got a really bad release date. Maybe it's not a good movie to do.
Peter Rabbit, they were like, look, we're going to have to push it back due to the pandemic. We're pushing it back to August. And everybody went to me, what? What are you talking about? Don't do that.
Well, it's not an Easter themed movie.
Yeah. Well, I know that, but I'm just saying much in the same way, you don't release an Easter themed movie in, say, September.
It's Peter Rabbit, not Peter Cottontail. Different guys. He's nothing to do with Easter. Nothing.
Peter Rabbit?
Peter Rabbit is created by, it's a children's book. It has nothing to do with Easter. Nothing.
Well, maybe I should see the movie, read the book. I don't know. I don't know anything about it.
Beatrix Potter. For 100 years, you got to be. Peter Cottontail is the one who goes hopping down the bunny trail, hippity hoppity, Easter's on its way. Peter Rabbit is trying to steal carrots and gets into trouble.
When it comes to rabbits, I am obviously prejudiced.
And clearly. there's no prejudice in Europe, however. They're all facing the pandemic no matter what country you're in. Italy is closing its cinemas again. Spain just instituted a curfew. I know people are very upset, and the theme parks in particular in North America feel like they've been treated differently than other similar businesses. I empathize. Unfortunately, I believe the response might not be, oh, we should be open too, but that those other people maybe should be shut down. Because that's, we're really facing a big, big upsurge in the pandemic. That's why Legally Blonde 3 has been pushed back to 2022. That's why the James Bond film, woof, this freaked people out. It's not happening, but they did store a toy with the idea of selling it to a streamer, didn't they?
Yes, they did for $600 million. And you know what?
You want to triple your budget. That's what you got to do.
Yeah. So Apple, they got out a piece of paper and they looked at their spreadsheets and they started to do the math and they said, you know, okay, they got 600 million times to carry the one. Yeah, no, we're not doing that. That's way too much money.
It's also more than a James Bond film has ever grossed at the box office. They never grossed $1.2 billion. And that's at least what you would have to gross in order for them to take home a cold, hard cash of $600 million. Yeah. So, it's a big ask, but you know, when you got a $200 million movie that valuable, I'm not surprised if they said, well, we're not thinking of doing it, but would you pay us this?
Well, here's the thing. If there was one company that was going to do it, I would say Amazon, there's no reason for you to do it. You already have these people. You're going to have these subscribers to Amazon Prime Video no matter what. So you don't need to. Now, Apple, on the other hand, your Apple TV Plus. Okay,
I would
you know
use
what?
That $600 million and put it down towards a library. Why yes. They didn't buy a library, I have no idea. And, this is another story for another day as well, but you really should explore the idea. Should a studio buy a movie theater chain? You know, we just had Universal and Warner Brothers go, no. But like, if they are now legally allowed to, I'm not talking about whether they should or whether it should be allowed or a new government might say, no, there's antitrust issues. But in the new world that we have, does it make sense for Warner Brothers to buy, say, AMC? Because, you know what? You get 80, 90% of the gross of your own movies, and you get like half of what your competitors release, too. So when Disney puts out a movie, you go, oh, I'm very glad Avengers made a lot of money. Oh, there's half for me, half for you. Half for me, half for you. That seems like a fun thing to do. I don't know. I'm just saying. But there are reboots on the way. Smokey and the Bandit is a TV show. Flashdance.
Wait, what's Smokey and the Bandit?
That's, we talked about it before. It's the Burt Reynolds.
I know
film.
It's a callback joke. Come on.
Well, you didn't say it was. You didn't know what. Not aware of it. You just said you didn't know Coors was involved.
No.
Flashdance is being turned into a TV series, even though there are very few female welders anymore in Pittsburgh or wherever they were. And Battlestar Galactica is being turned into a feature film, which
talked about this last week.
I don't think that works. Yeah. Well, the one thing we didn't talk about is the British Hay Festival. This is upsetting news. It's not good. And let me try to be clear here. I am not in any way, shape, or form criticizing the woman who suffered this horrific attack. The British Hay Festival decided to mount a book event in Abu Dhabi, following the wake of lots of other people who say, let's have a film festival or a music festival or vacation in Abu Dhabi. I find it morally suspect. I feel like you're vacationing in apartheid South Africa. And I think you should not be having an offshoot of NYU in Abu Dhabi, because your female professors, your Jewish professors, and your queer professors are not safe there, and they're not legally protected there. And now what's happened is that there is an accusation that a royal minister sexually assaulted Caitlin McNamara, the curator of the fest, when she was in country in February of this year. The UK is now considering whether to charge the minister with that crime. Obviously, he's not in their legal jurisdiction. But here's an ironic bit. The man involved is the UAE's Minister of Tolerance. How's that for an ugly, ugly coincidence? My point here is, obviously, this is dreadful, dreadful news. I'm glad she came forward and is public about it. She has nothing to be ashamed about. Only this man and Abu Dhabi and the United Arab Emirates have a reason to be ashamed. But I do wish they would think again about, why are we having a book festival in a country where women are not safe, where women do not have the same basic rights as men, where if you go to the police and say, I was raped, they will throw you in jail because they are calling you a whore and a prostitute because you're not allowed to have sex outside of marriage. So I have nothing but empathy for this woman. And I hope, you know, the UK makes whatever they can of it. It's a horrific situation. And I understand the desire to try to reach out to other countries and have cultural, you know, back and forth. But you're holding a festival in that country, you know, they don't have basic rights for the people you're asking to go there. This is not a good thing to do. So I think it's a big deal. I hope they will reconsider. I'm not telling people, never have people from UAE come to your events. No, I'm not saying that. But going to that country and giving them that legitimacy, Wynton Marsalis does it. They have Jazz Fest there. They have film festivals there. They have partnerships to make movies there. I just think it's the wrong way to do it. That ain't ping pong diplomacy. That's making a buck and putting your ethics to one side.
By the way, do two things. One, look up ping pong diplomacy, because okay. That's quite interesting. And okay. Our friend Chris Fenton was in his book.
Absolutely.
As well. You did say that it was a big deal. So it must be time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or really just overhyped nonsense.
Hold on a second. Well, give me 1 second. I just have to step off my soapbox. Okay, I'm back on solid ground. Okay, let's go.
Okay. Well, this is what you want for a new series, okay, our first story. Lovecraft Country debuted on HBO to great reviews and really a solid sampling. Week by week, the buzz kept building, and by the season one finale, the show hit a 1.5 million viewers in the overnights, we don't really talk about overnights anymore. There's a reason for that. See all of our previous episodes. That includes both airings, by the way, on HBO and presumably HBO Max and the like. Based on the novel by Matt Ruff, which Michael was touting as soon as it came out in 2017, by the way, hat tip to self. The show was created and overseen by showrunner Misha Green. She was supported by heavyweights like J.J. Abrams, Jordan Peele, and rising executive Rachel Rush Rich, who is a co-executive producer on the project. And unlike Watchmen, there's definitely room for a season two. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal. And here's the thing. I saw this story in Deadline. And like you say, we don't talk about overnight ratings very much for good reason. Buried towards the bottom of this story in Deadline, not touting it as a big thing, something I hadn't heard about, even though I'm obsessed with TV ratings and I'm really excited by this show, Lovecraft Country. It mentioned, oh, by the way, the first episode is now approaching 10 million views. Which is like a lot, a lot more than 1.5 million. That's a huge success story. That's what are episode 2 and 3 and 4? Like, that's a lot. That's huge. That should not be a secret. You know, TV ratings are broken. It's an important tool. It can really help promote television. They need to move away from overnight ratings like they're talking about, but they need to learn how to promote this stuff so people are aware of it. We've got ideas. Call us. But
yes, you can call us at 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. Or you can write to us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. Or follow us on Twitter. In fact, everybody who's listening to this, if you're on Twitter, follow us there. @ShowbizSandbox is our handle. What you'll find on Twitter is that you learn about some of these upcoming news stories first from our account.
Exactly. And speaking of HBO and HBO Max in North America, they're at about 38 million combined, beating their personal goal of 36 million by this point. They added 1.7 million subscribers when all is said and done. So that's good. And their worldwide total is 57 million subscribers.
And when you add in all the people who are using somebody else's password, it's 150 million. No, I'm just kidding. Anyway,
by the way, can you share your password with me?
I was going to ask you actually after we finished. But in any case, speaking of ratings, the Baseball World Series is over. Almost over. Although I'll tell you something, after game 4 of the World Series, I was pretty much done with it. Gosh darn Dodgers. Anyway, the ratings are actually unfortunately pretty dreadful. Game 1 hit the lowest ratings ever, okay? Ever. Okay, for a baseball game. And by the way, baseball in the U.S., it's not alone. Indeed, the New York Times has a story about how ratings are down for major sports across the board, and yet no one, absolutely no one, is doing what I would be doing when I saw that last play of Game 4 of the World Series. They're not panicking. Why? It's 2020, man. Truly, the reasons for lowered ratings are countless and probably unique. Usually, sports dominate at different times of the year. But because of the pandemic, many sports ended up competing with, well, one another. On one Sunday in September, games were played by the NFL, the NBA, Major League Baseball, the National Hockey League, Major League Soccer, and the WNBA. That had never happened before in history, okay? Toss in weird start times, a poor product with no screaming fans in the stands to whoop up excitement, other things on people's minds like, you know, an election and not dying from COVID-19. Yes, you know, I'm not worried about dying from as much as I am about catching COVID-19. And while advertisers, by the way, and owners are really, they're calling for a do-over, we would like to start 2020 all... Oh, wait, no, actually...
No, we just want to go on to 2021.
That is true. Where's my time machine? Oh, and by the way, when some say the NBA's ratings tumbled because of social activism, the numbers just don't reflect that, really. Besides, why were numbers down for the Kentucky Derby? Did the horses, like, kneel during the national anthem? I don't think so. In fact, part of the reason they were down is because it was in September, not May, okay? Anyway, big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal. They are way down across the board, and there's a lot of very good reasons that you detailed that we pulled from that New York Times story. We have the link in our show notes. It's a very good story. And as they pointed out, if you think social activism is what's hurting some of these sports, well, the fact is that perhaps the most socially active league is the WNBA here in North America, and they have probably suffered the least in the ratings. So it really just doesn't track. It doesn't mean, hey, social activism is helping you, but it's not the bugaboo that we're talking about here. It's really all these other very obvious and clear problems that we're having putting on a sporting event.
Well, and also, you know, you mentioned the first time in history that all those games were
played. Yeah, they're all conflicting with each other, yeah.
Think about it this way. Right now, a Los Angeles team is competed and won the NBA championship in the month of October. Two weeks later, you have the Los Angeles Dodgers playing in the World Series, competing for a championship.
Mm-hmm.
Has that ever happened before? I don't think so.
Nope. And people barely know it. Oh, is it happening? You know.
Yes.
Not good.
Well, in a blow for the public commons, songwriter and satirist Tom Lehrer has released everything he ever created into the public domain. All his lyrics and sheet music are out there for anyone to grab, to which most rock musicians said, sheet music? What sheet music? No, just kidding. Anyway,
they know what it is.
I know.
Rock fans don't know what it is. Yeah.
Lehrer's heyday was back in the 1950s and 1960s. So most of the songs you can check out for free they're about the nuclear bomb and rocket scientist Wernher von Braun and the like. But still, it's a statement of what artists can and might do. So tell me, is this a big deal or a big whoop? And does it depend on whether you're just a guy on a podcast or Tom Lehrer's grandson?
Exactly. The relatives of the artist may not be so happy, but I think it's a big deal, and it shows a way forward for people to choose on their own to say enough with the copyright and to release it into the public domain. It's important to do. Profit from it as much as you can, but make a plan to make it part of the public commons, because that's what artists should do, and that's great of Tom Lehrer to do it. It's easy to do it when your revenue is probably much lower today than it was 30, 40, 50 years ago. Nonetheless, it's a good thing he didn't have to do it, and I think it's great.
You know, speaking of the AFI Fest, which we spoke about earlier, I saw a film there that was called Hopper Wells. It was effectively a two-hour conversation between
Dennis Hopper and Orson Welles.
Dennis Hopper and Orson Welles. Orson Welles shot it on black and white film with his own money, and it was really just about
they were just shooting.
Yeah, and you know what? Some of the things that were discussed then, you know, you had Dennis Hopper talking about there's going to be a revolution, man. You know, there's you know, all of the problems that this country faced, America faced,
or the world,
and the world, very similar. Yeah. To today. And he said, you know, I don't like reading the newspapers. I like watching news on television. You know, if it was on all the time, if it was on like 24 hours a day, I'd just watch the news. I was like, oh, Dennis. If only you know what's coming. In any case, you know, Netflix, by the way, we talked about them too earlier. They told everyone they wouldn't be able to maintain their pace of, you know, their hugely pandemic fueled growth. Okay. They said, you know, that was fun, but it might not last. By the way, they were right. Okay. The company signed up 26 million subscribers in the first half of the year. That's enormous. And the third quarter, they signed up just 2.2 million subscribers. Unfortunately, the company had predicted 2.5 million subscribers.
Sell.
Yes, absolutely. Right now. You know, Wall Street analysts were looking for 3.6 million subscribers, so you know they were selling. Revenue was on target, but earnings per share were off and not in a good way. The result? Netflix stock took a hit, and somebody somewhere surely said, Netflix is dead, Disney Plus is king. It may have been us. I'm not sure. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It is a big whoop.
Yes,
they had massive growth earlier in the year. The fact that they weren't accurately able to nail down exactly how much it would slow down at this point, big deal. Who cares?
By the way, if you were following the Showbiz Sandbox Twitter feed, you would have known about this almost in time as it happened, like maybe 20 minutes after it happened. You would have found out right away.
My God, that's exciting.
Yes, indeed. Maybe as exciting as Universal Music Group, which is going public. It's been talked about for a long time, and owner Vivendi says the IPO is a go because there is never a better time to go public, it's happening in 2022. So, okay, they're not raring to take Universal Music Group public, but they definitely will someday, eventually, in 2022. And hey, they've got good news to share. UMG is making a lot of money in streaming, like, you know, $1 million in the
billion,
last quarter.
Billion.
Oh, did I say million? Yes, mm-hmm. one billion. Sorry, that is a huge mistake. Speaking of huge mistake, you know, 26 million to 2.2 million. Yeah, well, 1 million to 1 billion. Yeah, that's a big mistake. During a pandemic, by the way, they're making that money. Hey, it helps to have The Weeknd, Justin Bieber, Billie Eilish, BTS, Post Malone, and the like on your roster. So is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big whoop. It's so far in the future. We've known they've been talking about it for quite a long time. They've pulled back, pulled forward, and they're like, we're going to do it 2 years from now. Well, yes. You know, call us, Michael, when it's closer.
I am going to be a millionaire in 2035. Okay. Yes, 2035.
Awesome.
Yeah, future, but also it might not happen. So heads up.
All right.
So now ebook lending at libraries exploded in the UK during the last few months, of course. The pandemic-fueled surge kicked into high gear, a trend that's been building for years, according to the charity Library Connection. Titles ranging from Harry Potter to Michelle Obama's memoir and Hillary Mantel's, I know it's Hillary Mantel, right? I
mean, right.
Her finale to her Cromwell trilogy are among the titles about, you know, people borrowed the most, really. Libraries caution that ebooks are much more expensive than physical books and that digital loans shouldn't make anyone think physical libraries aren't necessary anymore. But yes, ebooks are more popular than ever right now at your local library. Is this a big deal or a big whoop? I'm really surprised that ebooks cost more than physical books. I know why that is, and I'm sure you will tell us.
You mean it for libraries?
For libraries, yes.
Right.
Yes.
They tend to cost similar or sometimes a little bit more, even in physical, you know, hardcover versus paperback. But libraries, the publishers are freaked out by libraries, even though they're one of their biggest customers. They know if they buy a hardcover book, it will wear out. You know, you can only lend one at a time, which is part of the requirement of an ebook, and the physical print book will wear out eventually. If they got to buy 50 copies of a new Tom Clancy, they know a bunch of them will get worn out and be, you know, sold or remaindered or whatever, gotten rid of. And the others, if they need more, they'll have to buy more again. Ebooks, of course, don't wear out ever. And so they're worried about like them buying just one copy and having it forever. They're like, we're supposed to make more money if it remains popular for years. Most books, you don't need them years down the road. Those are only the mainstays. Ebooks, however, they say you got to pay like $60 to buy it. And after 2 years, you got to buy it again or 1 year or after 50 loans. They all have different standards. It's all a big mess. And the libraries are like, we're not your enemy. People who go to the library also tend to buy books, actually. They're big breeders. It's a good thing. And even if nobody ever went to a bookstore again, libraries are a great source of revenue. But anyway, it's a big problem. I love libraries. I use them more than ever. I like to see people using ebooks because I think it's great to have that as a service, but we have to recognize it costs them more money and finance them properly to do that. We also have to help the Strand, apparently. They're saying, help the Strand, the big bookstore in New York City, 12, 18 miles of books. They're saying, we may not make it.
Yeah. So, okay. The Strand is like Powell's in Portland, Oregon, and like many, famous bookstores around the world. This is New York's, probably its most famous bookstore, wouldn't you say, along with maybe the original Barnes & Noble?
Right now, certainly.
Yeah. Well, okay. So this is, I love going to the Strand. It's been around for 70 some odd years. And the owner is saying, oh my goodness, we're going broke because nobody's buying anything. And New York City's a ghost town. Just ask our president who said New York City's a ghost town. And then I guess it came out the same day. This owner took the PPP, the grant money from the government for the coronavirus relief, and then still managed to fire everybody anyway. And by the way, she also owns the building. So what's the deal? Oh, and she bought stock in Amazon.
Yeah, well, that's not a crime. But yes, by the way, I had no idea that Barnes & Noble began in New York. But you're right. It was called Heinz & Noble back in the day in the 1800s. And you learn something new every day on Showbiz Sandbox. So I'm not sure what to think of their travails. Sometimes you have to feel they have crocodile tears. They're not lovable people, the folks in charge of the Strand. They don't treat their employees that well. And I'm sorry that so many of their employees had to be fired. That's really heartbreaking because it's a good transitional job for people, also for some people homeless and other people. It's an institution, and I hope they survive. But so
do I.
Yeah.
You know, I will say this: if you took the PPP money, that's the paycheck.
Well, no, that's what somebody said, and that obviously you can't. You have to keep paying people if you did, or you got to pay it all back, et cetera. So that's unclear to me.
Yeah, for months and certainly weeks, the theme parks in California have been pleading with Governor Newsom for a coherent plan. They got that, actually. Finally, the state responded, and Disneyland and others are, well, they're not happy. Smaller theme parks can reopen with a cap of 500 visitors. Disneyland and the like are blocked from reopening until their area reaches Tier 4. Not to get into the weeds on this, because it's very easy to do in this state of California, but Disneyland says it should be treated like other similar businesses, and it is not, said an industry trade group in a statement. To say today's announcement on theme parks is disappointing would be a grave understatement. The governor has not used science or data to inform his decision. Theme parks have opened and operated safely around the world for months. It says, but now that was said by that trade group representative, they're refusing to let these theme parks reopen for the foreseeable future. The theme park industry is being devastated. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, you tell me. I know the parks are considering suing California State and the governor for their actions and saying, look, it's not based on anything reasonable. I empathize with them. Like I said before, I feel like with all the surge in COVID, you know what? Everything may be shut down again, but they want to be treated the same as other similar businesses if they can demonstrate with a reasonable medical backing and scientific backing that they can operate relatively safely with restrictions, then obviously they should be able to. It's presumably safer than sitting inside a restaurant or a crowded bar. But
yeah, I mean, I think that Disney has a point here. Much like the movie theater chains have a point, when you look at what is going on in New York and you say, so churches can be open, but movie theaters can't, and that makes no sense at all since they are effectively the same type of venue. It's completely random and somewhat politicized. With the case of Disneyland in California, part of the problem with California is the fact that they have set these guidelines to a point where, and I said this, the moment that they set these guidelines where they, every day the infection rate has to be below 7 out of every 100,000 people. I said at the time, Los Angeles County will never hit that, ever. And we have never hit it, not even close. We are in no way, shape, or form going to get to less than 7 in 100,000 people for 2 weeks straight.
An argument for saying the governor is right, and if it's not safe to open up when it's at that level is crazy, has no link to reality?
Because you look at where, like, I live in a part of town where the rate of infection is probably like 0.5 in 100,000.
So you think the area is too big?
The area is too big. The level just makes no sense. I think you're going to have to start really, and by the way, the state of California is beginning to realize this too, because they're saying, well, okay, tattoo parlors and massage parlors, you guys can open up. I mean, even though that was one of the things that couldn't open up, they're now kind of beginning to relax this, because what they're seeing is you're just never going to hit those numbers. You've created an unrealistic number. And Disneyland is saying the same thing. They're saying, yeah, we asked for a plan. You basically said the same thing that you had said previously. You just said it in reverse order. So yeah, no.
All right. Well, that wraps up Big Deal, Big Whoop and brings us into Inside Baseball. That's where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. And by you, I mean Jeffrey Katzenberg and
Meg Whitman.
Meg Whitman. Heavens. Quibi, dead. Talk to me.
Yes. Here's how it's going to affect me. It means I will never download that app. I haven't downloaded it today.
I meant to do it during the freebie period, and I forgot to do it. I
never downloaded it. I had no interest.
Right. Quibi,
now, Quibi was the bite-sized content platform. You know, as you say, Jeffrey Katzenberg founded it, along with Meg Whitman, former CEO of eBay and HP. It was mocked from the moment it was announced, okay? And now it's completely dead after 6 months. And by the way, $2 billion. That's how much money they raised. And a fruitless attempt to find a buyer, basically. And by the way, Jeffrey Katzenberg, listen, Michael and I have told you numerous times, we are not going to buy Quibi from you, okay? So just stop calling us.
By the way, never should have given my number.
I know, God.
Now, they will bitterly insist people were gunning for them from the start. But the simple truth is that Quibi was an answer in search of a problem. The first problem, I think, with this company, as we've talked before, is they claimed no one was creating high-quality short-form videos that would be perfect for people who are commuting or just had a few minutes in line at the bank, whatever. But, of course, they were ignoring the massive success of high-quality video, like music videos, comedy sketches from Saturday Night Live, The Daily Show, all the late-night talk shows, and so much more. They acted like
Michael, I'm sorry. I can you repeat that? I wasn't actually paying attention because I was on YouTube watching one of my influencers who, wow. That's a really good cooking video.
Well, right. They wanted to pretend that the only videos were by nobodies. And I'm putting that in quotes since, you know, a lot of these people that they mock on YouTube and stuff make good money and create quality videos that people are happy to watch. But they said, no, people want Hollywood quality stuff with big stars and we can provide it. You're like, I don't feel like there's a big market for that. Then you find out they're going to charge for it. And you're like, instead of going to YouTube or another place, okay.
You find out that, oh, this is really good content, Jeffrey Katzenberg. You're right. This is fantastic. I'm going to share it. Oh, wait, there's no way for me to share this.
Oh, my God. Yeah, at their presentation to investors, they're like, well, how do you share it on, you know, Twitter or Facebook or Instagram? Oh, well, that's coming later, or it's not necessary. Or it's like, ay, ay, ay.
So and then they got sued. They have a patent lawsuit that they're facing by, you know, it's a pretty hefty lawsuit where the you know, they had that like transitional video where like you turned it sideways and it was a different view.
That was their big thing. People want to be able to turn their phone one way. I mean, this, what are they thinking? They're like, oh, I'm watching something vertically, but what if I want to turn it horizontally and keep watching it? Well, you have little bars on the side or whatever. But the idea that you should have different video depending on how, it's like, what? It's like ridiculous. Nobody's sitting there going, gee, I'm enjoying this video, but I sure wish I could turn it horizontally every once in a while and see something different. It's like, that's crazy. And just to think how bad they were doing in the breakdown when it was just ending, people were saying, well, they were just starting to pivot and think maybe we should have a freemium level rather than asking people to pay $5 a month. Like that wasn't part of the plan at the start. That it's just,
but you know, so let's say they do a freemium offer, right?
Or did.
They're going to have advertisers, okay? And the advertisers are squeezed right now for, you know, there's a recession on. Well, they decided to launch in April in the midst of a pandemic when everybody was so focused on it.
This wasn't going to work in April or January or 2 years from now.
I'm not saying it would. I liked what Steven Zaychek said in the Washington Post. He said, Quibi also might have missed a fundamental truth. People don't like watching addictive stories on their phones because they'd rather keep those phones free to tweet, text, and Instagram about them. The second screen, in other words, requires a first.
Well, I disagree with that just for the reasons we said before. People do watch videos on their phone. They do watch stuff on their computer, but there's a ton of free stuff for them to choose from that is high quality. And they don't watch a music video and always tweet about it. No, they don't need two screens because they're tweeting about whatever they're watching on one. That does happen. But no, I've seen people all the time on their commutes watching on their iPad or their laptop or their phone.
Yeah. Did you say a commute?
That's, again, there's tons of content out there. It doesn't matter whether there was a pandemic or not. They want to blame the pandemic and they're like, well, that's part of the problem. We're like, you know what? The problem is Quibi. It was poorly conceived from the start. I'm sure they would have created some good content. But the big fallout is people are now scared. Now they're saying, well, great. Now that they've done this, no one's going to be able to raise any money again in Hollywood because they raised so much money. Yeah, give me a break. It's Jeff Katzenberg. Everybody knows him. They trusted him. They took a flyer on it. Didn't work. They'll move on to the next good idea. Somebody has an idea and can convince them, they'll line up with their checkbooks open.
And they're not bankrupt. They're basically saying, look, we don't see a way to become profitable right now. And so we're going to return money to our investors.
Yeah. Let's wind down in a somewhat responsible way. A hat tip to them. I mean, that is admirable. They didn't just burn through every last penny like people normally do. They said, look, it's not working. We know we're not going to turn this around. And so we're going to try and not burn through every dollar that we have and actually return some of it. They're not going to make money. They're not going to get back all the money they invested, but at least we can behave responsibly here. That's not easy to do. So I give them full credit. Though.
Well, that's a big tech industry thing. Fail fast, fail often.
Yeah. And Meg Whitman, now the Biden people are thinking about bringing her into the administration. That was being floated in one of the stories. I'm like, oh, please no.
Please don't. Yes. Oh, God.
I mean, think about it.
Look at eBay. Look at Skype, look at HP,
look at
Quibi, and you will see right away that maybe
she doesn't pick winners. Yeah. She doesn't pick winners. So please no. But you know, more full credit for her for getting to where she did. But I don't want her in the Biden administration. I hope those dreams are dead, but other people are dead too. There's a lot of cool people and interesting people.
And like I promised you guys, I'm going to keep them moving. Come on, Michael, you can do it. March champion, dancer, and choreographer dies. How old was she?
I forgot to write. How old was Marge champion? She was
working in the 40s, so she had to be quite old.
Oh, she wasn't young. She was 101. God bless her. She was as a kid, she danced at the Hollywood Bowl. As a teenager, she was the model for three Disney film characters, Snow White in Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, the Blue Fairy in Pinocchio, and the Hippo Ballerinas in Fantasia. That alone would get her a little, credit in pop culture world. But her career really took off both personally and professionally when she partnered with Gower Champion in 1947. They got married. They brought up an act. Just as Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers were fading away, doing their own separate things, they were starting to appear on TV Weekly in 1949. They did dance stories, telling a story like you might see on, So You Think You Can Dance. And they really picked up where that famous duo left off. And that led to Broadway reviews, nightclubs, movies, and lots of TV. They did drift apart, with Gower famously dying hours before the musical he directed, 42nd Street, opened on Broadway in 1980. Her last performance on Broadway was in 2001 during Stephen Sondheim's Follies, a revival of that show, which I remember seeing. I got to see her on stage. So that is very cool.
Well, both Marge Champion and I share something in common. She was the model for three Disney characters. I was the model for one.
Oh.
Gaston, the big...
I didn't know that. I was thinking you were going to go with Jiminy Cricket, but anyway.
Oh, Pinocchio. No. Well, also dying was British publisher Tom Maskler. He died at the age of 87. He fled Nazi Germany, where he headed to the UK.
No, he wasn't in Nazi Germany. He fled the Nazis, but he was in Vienna, I believe. So he wasn't in Nazi Germany, but he did flee them and he headed to the UK, became a publishing sensation when named to head a major imprint at just 26. Where did we go wrong? Anyway, he had great taste and a flair for publicity. He said the greatest writer he ever worked with was Gabriel Garcia Marquez. No argument here. Nadine Gordimer, Doris Lessing, V.S. Naipaul, lots of other people that really, he made a big deal with. And then people he worked with, like Bruce Chatwin, on and on and on. He also helped found the Booker Prize. That's an enduring accomplishment as well. Fun guy. And you know what? World War II and the Nazis seem like such distant, far past. Like what a separate century. It's not, people are still dying their lives were affected by World War II and the rise of fascism in Nazi Germany and Italy. It's good to remember that.
Yeah, like seeing a guy stand out on a balcony like Mussolini, lording it over. Oh,
vote. Yeah. Emmy screenwriter William Blinn has died at the age of 83. I had never heard of him.
Yeah, well, he created Starsky and Hutch, so
yeah. Kind of. That's very cool. He came to Hollywood with a friend. They started pitching scripts. He got a staff job on Bonanza. And like you say, he created Starsky and Hutch. He helped some other shows as well, didn't he?
Eight is Enough.
Right.
Bonanza.
He didn't develop Eight Bonanza. He just was on staff there. He helped develop Eight is Enough. He's an official creator on Starsky and Hutch. He led the writing staff on Fame for three seasons. He didn't help create that show, but he was involved very early on. And that show won Emmy nominations for Best Drama all 3 years. I watched it every week. And it always lost to Hill Street Blues. No shame in that. That's one of the great shows of all time. And because he was on Fame, that led him to co-writing the film Purple Rain, his only screen credit.
Well, you know, he just message in from William Blinn from Heaven. He said, Fame, he's actually not going to live forever.
Oh, gee.
Nice. Come on, that was a good one.
That was a good one. I apologize to his family and friends if they take offense at that. We don't mean anything bad by that. You know, speaking of music, he was working on Purple Rain. He didn't really know Prince from Adam, you know, and he was meeting with him and like, okay, you know, and trying to work on the movie. Not a great script, by the way, but anyway, he co-wrote it with the director. But, you know, he hung out with Prince, and Prince took him in his car. They got in the car, and Prince played like When Doves Cry for him while they were driving around. It hadn't been released yet, of course. And he's like, wow, you really got something here. That's a good song. It's like, well, you're right. And I'm really dancing around his two really big projects that are the reason he will be remembered forever. So his big break was being random.
Alex Haley Roots?
Yeah, Roots? He was involved on Roots and worked with Alex Haley, wrote 3 of the 8 episodes, a key writer on the TV miniseries Roots. And then his big break right before that was when he was there doing Bonanza and stuff. He was randomly assigned to develop a script based on a sports biography, and they wanted to turn it into a TV movie. That became Brian's Song. At the time, it was the most watched made-for-TV movie of all time and the fourth highest-rated movie shown on TV, like following stuff like Sound of Music and things like that. So it was the biggest TV movie of all time, made-for-TV movie. And then a year or two later, he worked on Roots, which was, of course, the biggest miniseries of all time and a sensation to top all sensations. So cool, interesting career.
Speaking of cool and interesting, set designer Ming Cho Lee, she died at 90.
She?
Oh, I thought it was a she.
Well, I don't believe so, but I mean, that's okay. That's okay. I mean, when people make the sense.
It's
a man, Ming Cho Lee. That's quite all right. Ming is a name you might, I assume Lee Cho Ming is you would the way, I'm not sure if it's been transposed properly, but this man was born in Shanghai and he retired a few years ago as a professor at the Yale School of Drama, where he worked on set design and other things. As a Chinese American, he was a groundbreaking set designer on Broadway, at the Public Theater, and at the Metropolitan Opera. I tried to get info on sets he did for the Met, but I was unable to. He did win the Tony. He won the Tony for his set design for the mountain climbing play K2. I remember this play. I was nowhere near New York when it opened up, but I remember everybody saying, well, it's this okay drama about mountain climbing, but damn, that set is great. You know, you got them climbing a mountain and everybody's like, wow, that's a set. He also worked at the Public Theater for many years, including the original mounting at the Public of For Color Girls, which moved on to Broadway. It started before the Public, but when he got there, he set the design that took it to Broadway and made it really a sensation. You know, pretty cool stuff. He did a lot of great stuff. And speaking of theater, he's a trailblazer. So is Edith O'Hara. She's the founder of the New York City's 13th Street Rep. She did that in 1972. She died at 103 in her apartment above the theater. That's how it's done. You got to own the building.
Okay, well, you know who didn't own his building, I'm sure, maybe. I don't know.
Probably not.
The amazing Randy, who died at the age of 92. Now, he was an illusionist, like a magician. He did all these escape tricks. Died at 92, and I have to say that my Twitter exploded when this occurred.
Really?
Yes, I don't know why. I was like, who is this amazing Randy guy? Oh my God, he's really good.
Back in the day, he was a big deal. He appeared on the Today Show back in 1952 by breaking a record set by Houdini on the Today Show, the morning show, by staying inside a metal coffin submerged underwater for 104 minutes. He got out of a straitjacket while suspended over Niagara Falls, but he grew bored with magic a little bit. He devoted decades to debunking frauds. He loved illusions and he hated people who used it to rook people and cheat them. Uri Geller's not the worst of those, but he did famously crash a Uri Geller appearance on The Tonight Show where that guy who used to pretend, I can bend spoons with my mind, he pretended he actually could do it. And so he didn't get away with that, not with the amazing Randy around. And Randy appeared on The Tonight Show dozens of times. He also took down evangelist Peter Popoff and showed how he pulled his trick. He inspired Penn and Jillette. And he found
actually, he inspired Penn and Teller.
Oh,
because Penn Jillette is one person.
I'm sorry. Thank you for correcting that. He also founded or co-founded the Committee for Skeptical Inquiry with scientist Carl Sagan, sci-fi writer Isaac Asimov, and others. At one point, he offered $1 million to anyone who could demonstrate supernatural ability under scientific criteria. Move objects with your mind. Bend a spoon, Yuri. Come on over. Make $1 million. Read minds. Do whatever you want. Do it under scientific conditions, and we'll say, hey, here's your $1 million. No one ever collected. And, you know, my friend is the husband. This is his claim to fame. He is the husband. My friend from the IRAs. That voting film group that I belong to. His wife is Marguerite Fox, who was an obituary writer at the New York Times. She is retired, but there are obituaries booked like this one for The Amazing Randy, and she really captures him well in her opening sentence. James Randi, a MacArthur award-winning magician who turned his formidable savvy to investigating claims of spoon bending, mind reading, fortune telling, ghost whispering, water dowsing, faith healing, UFO spotting, and sundry varieties of bamboozlement, bunco, chicanery, flim-flam, flummery, humbuggery, mountbankery, pettifoggery, and out-and-out quacksalvery, as he quite often saw fit to call them, died on Tuesday at his home in Plantation, Florida. He was 92. So we have a link to her obituary. She's a great writer. She's written nonfiction books now, too. You should check them out. So enjoy that. And there's one person I'd like to celebrate today who is not dead. It's pianist Keith Jarrett, one of the great jazz and classical pianist of all time. He suffered a stroke a few years ago and then another stroke. He may never be able to perform again. He is alive and kicking. The New York Times has a profile. He hopes to regain enough ability and control of his left hand so he can hold a cup of coffee. Playing the piano is simply not in the cards. It's very sad. He is a remarkable talent playing jazz, classical, and especially solo improvisational concerts, which have become his thing. His discography is overwhelming, but go there, dive in, check it out. And if you need help, start with 1975's The Koln Concert, K-O-L-N, The Koln Concert. That's a great solo improvisational performance. He's just a major artist, a major talent. It's sad to know he won't be able to perform in the future, but he'll be performing on CD and streaming forever. Great artist.
Now, we also had some listener email to dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. Now, we received so much email about our discussion about the Disney reorganization, which, by the way, almost everybody said...
You don't know what you're talking about.
Well, no, it's not that they said we don't know what we're talking about. Some did. But it was more, hey, yeah, this is all very confusing, and we don't think necessarily Bob Chapek's move here is going to pan out, at least not the way it's done. However, they said, look, they were all trying to... Set the confusion straight.
Oh, good, okay? good. Explain this to us. I didn't know about this. This is great.
And they said, look, usually at a studio or a network, you have like these different departments. One is all the content is developed and by one group of people or one group called, you know, it's called development.
Just read what you wrote. You're going to make it too complicated. Don't riff. Keep going. Explain it simply and directly.
Well, and whether it's television, motion pictures, it's a development team, basically, made up of, you know, executives that specialize in that. And then they approve budgets. They manage the production. Another group does distribution. And it's usually handled by a completely different department and different executives. Sometimes there's some intermingling. But the distribution department usually has very little, if any, say on what is being produced.
Right, so maybe are they like the marketers, or is that totally separate too? Because I know marketers sometimes they say, can you sell this product?
Yes, that's exactly what it is. It's, hey, this is what we're thinking of making. What do you think? But if they come back and say, it'll never work. Yeah, thanks for your opinion. Uh-huh. You know, it's usually,
right.
It's not like, hey, what should our budget be for this? Okay, which is what is happening now, because Disney is reversing this and creating a department that will make decisions about where content will be distributed. Will it be in a theater? Will it be online? Will it be on television?
But that should be the creatives. I mean, that's when you decide a project. I want to make this project for ESPN or Disney Plus or in movie theaters. I mean, isn't that inherent to what the project is? It's not like you decide where it's going to go and then say, okay, that means you get this budget. It's like, or they're just trying to say, this is, we don't know where this fits in all our platforms, or we think this belongs here. Or, I mean, that's
to show you how creative, unique, and innovative our listeners are. They more than once did I hear tail wagging the dog?
Oh, no. Don't make fun of them. That's a perfectly good description. Though if somebody says you really should say it's tail wagging the dog's butt, because the tail never makes the whole dog move, but you can maybe, if you're really lucky, make the butt move. So really, tail wagging the dog butt. Don't get ahead of yourself.
Yeah. Well, but here's the thing. So now this new department, you know, which is kind of a global department, they're going to oversee what's being distributed by saying where something gets distributed. Yes. You're also kind of determining the budget.
Well, of course you are. But that's the whole point of the people who decide what to make in the first place.
Correct.
Not the.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. But it's not going to be the head of Disney Plus and the head of ESPN or ESPN Plus. It's not going to be the head
of
Hulu.
The question.
It's going, not the head of ABC. It's not the head of Disney Theatrical. It's this new person.
Well, that's okay. So what you've just underscored right there, Michael, is the question. It's like, okay.
that's what they should have been solving.
So you've got the distribution people who will say where it gets distributed. You've got the development people who will decide how it gets made and how it gets developed. But who makes the decision as to what gets made? Okay.
That's the green light is the only thing that matters.
Right. And that is really, you know, the thing. Now, we also heard from a number of agents on a couple of things. I'll hold that comment for just a point.
Okay.
For just 1 second. The reason we didn't hear about certain executives, such as John Landgraf or Don Hudson, is for the same reason we didn't hear about like the head of distribution at Disney Theatrical or the head of ABC News, because those people are underneath the people we're hearing about. We didn't hear about the film executives under Alan Horn. Think Kathleen Kennedy over at Lucasfilm. We didn't hear about, you know, the head, like I said, the head of global theatrical distribution at Buena Vista Distribution. So we were hearing about the very tippy top, the literally tip top of the spear. So that's why we weren't hearing about Don Hudson and all of these people who were still be there.
But they didn't know where they fit in. Do they lose their green light ability? Do they not have the right to make a project and know where they want it to go? You know,
well, that goes back to that point you underscored before.
Yeah.
The agents were writing in to say, hey, you know what? If you've already got a deal done and a lot of these deals are done and you know the way deals get done in Hollywood, they're all going to go well in our previous deal. You know, you do these deals and then there's these little theatrical bumps. Oh, the movie made $100 million. You get an extra $200,000 in pay.
Well, it's a very different deal to put something on ABC versus theatrical versus Disney Plus versus Hulu. Right. Every deal has all these variables.
Well, with no theatrical revenue to tie to,
you need
well,
more
how
money.
Do you, how do you yeah, how do you get your bump? They also kind of took not umbrage, but there was the, I guess you and I had it out of Christopher Nolan versus this person. They said, look, those people, those A-listers,
they're a separate world.
Yeah, they're a separate world.
Exactly. That's what I said.
Yeah, but there are those people where they may not be household names, but you know they can kind of put a lot of pressure on an executive to try and get something theatrical over straight to video. And here's why. The whole business runs on relationships.
Sure.
And basically what this whole reorganization does is it says all those relationships that used to be in place, we're blowing them up. So the question is, who should I have a relationship with? And does it matter?
Right. Yeah. You want to be people in power, not us. You want to be, you want to be, friends with the important people. Yeah, well, I appreciate them writing in. I'm going to look over all the stuff they sent me, which you hadn't shared yet. So I really appreciate them clarifying that in some ways it was just as confusing to them. Here's why we weren't hearing about this, that, and the other person. And no, they haven't figured it out. And here's another problem you didn't point out. The contracts, as the agent said, those are all good points. So really appreciate people weighing in. And if they get any more clarity, feel free to reach out.
dirt@showbizsandbox.com, or you can call and leave us a voicemail. I can't wait until we actually get a voicemail that we can play. A lot of them, they would require a lot of editing for profane words. Let's just put it out. Also, we get a lot of fax machines. I'm not sure why, but we get a lot of fax machines. In any case, you can find that information on our website, showbizsandbox.com. You'll also find ways to subscribe to our show on that website. We can be found on iTunes, the Google Play Store, Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher. I don't think it's called Google Play anymore, by the way. Anyway, links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode can also be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where you'll find those ways to contact us. Remember, we're on Twitter @showbizsandbox is our handle, and on Facebook, we're at facebook.com/showbizsandbox. Again, all on our website, showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on their own website, who is MGMT.com. Michael Gilt has a website, and every week it's something new and exciting. What is it this week, Michael?
This week it's Quibi.com. Okay, sure, it's taken up this week, but I think it's going to be available soon.
Yeah, it actually might be true. Jeffrey Katzenberg is selling it. I see here, yeah, it's $2 billion.
More like 50 bucks.
If you can't find any of Michael's coverage of the entertainment industry there, why not head on over to michaelgiltz.com, where all of his work can be found. Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.